Hello and welcome back to Zero Credits, the podcast where we talk about things. My name is Henry.
I'm John.
And together we're Henry and John.
Accurate.
Thank you. I practiced.
So what's this podcast about?
Well, you know, that brings us to our first segment. What are we doing?
Oh, my favorite segment. What are we doing?
This podcast, we just talk about things, man. It's just like a conversation we're having, and if we come to topics we know, that's great. And if we don't have any topics, we'll spin the topic wheel.
So it's almost like we have zero credentials.
Oh, that's right.
Like we have zero credits in these specific areas.
Do we want to talk about why we picked that name?
Sure. I feel like I just covered it, but put them on blast.
See, when you go into an arcade,
mm-hmm.
you have to take your quarters and put them in a machine and you get credits.
What's an arcade?
An arcade is a building, and inside of that building are arcade machines that let you play video games.
Okay.
Have you ever heard of a game called Pac-Man?
I know of Galaga.
That's close. They're basically the same game.
Okay.
Usually in the same cabinet, you know, oddly enough.
What does Pac-Man shoot?
Diabetes right into his body because of the power pellets. They're made of sugar.
Great.
Anyway, to play these machines, you would have to insert these credits into the machine.
Okay.
So if you have 0 credits...
You have 0 credits.
You can't play the game.
Okay, so we can't play the game.
We can't play the game. Well, see, that's kind of the thing. It's like we're admitting we don't have any credits, but we're going to try to play the game.
Okay, so it's like you opened up the credits box arcade machine and took the jumper wire off and put it on a different dip switch and put it on free play.
Yes.
Turns out I know a lot about arcade games. Credentials for arcade games.
Why don't you insert one of them into the slot so we can talk?
Don't need to because it's on free play. Just hit a button.
So what you're trying to tell me is that like 2 episodes into this, we should have named this free play and not 0 credits?
I think free play would have a different connotation. I like the self-effacing nature of 0 credits as a name.
I believe when I pitched the name, you said, and I'm going to quote you here.
All right.
That's millennial enough to work.
Is that really what I said?
You said that.
You know, I stand by it. I stand by it. All you millennials out there listening, you know what I'm talking about. You know. Hopefully they get it.
I mean, as someone who's been described or technically fits into the category of a millennial, I don't get it.
I mean, I guess... What's the cutoff for millennials? Like 29, 31?
29 to 31, yeah.
It's been pretty fungible up until this point. Fungible, is that the word?
Like you're fudging the numbers?
Fudgible. It's been pretty fudgible up until this point what a millennial is. But basically it seems like anyone born in the late 80s, early 90s, kind of, up until the present day, is a millennial.
Well, see, there was Generation X, Gen X, then there was Generation Y.
Uh-huh.
What's after Generation Y?
Millennials.
Is that it?
It has to be. They did this Gen Z thing for a while, but I think millennial is a powerful term, and it does describe a certain subset of people that we certainly belong to.
Yeah, because, but you know what happens when you put a blanket over like a group of people?
Do you end up with a whole bunch of misinformed people pretending they know what this demographic likes, even though it's really diverse? Potentially more diverse than any demographic that has come before it?
Exactly, and also, they're hard to see. Because there's a blanket over them.
Yeah, most millennials do wear a lot of blankets.
I mean, like, you blanket term.
Throw
a blanket. Sorry, okay. I was doing wordplay.
But no, that is true. Actually, it might be truer than you think, because if you do put a blanket term over something, it is harder to see the individual.
I mean, you described it perfectly with your very long answer, and I was just being, you know, kind of undercutting and.
But we both basically came to the same conclusion: 0 credits.
That is a little taste of the show.
All right, we like to talk about millennials and what millennials like.
Sure,
look. If anything, major corporations have taught me that millennials like beards, they like beer, they like music I don't like, and they like plaid shirts, they like ironic cars, and they are big fans of the word cha.
You know, can I pause right here and just ask, what is an ironic car?
So, I have more to say about this subject than you might imagine. Generally, what people perceive to be ironic cars, or at least in car culture, what the general hatred towards millennials slash hipsters slash weird authentic or inauthentic people is you get a car that you think makes you look old or uncool.
So, like, you get an Oldsmobile.
Yeah, like, you get an Oldsmobile, you get a Volvo, you get something that's hatchbacky.
A station wagon?
Yeah, station wagons, definitely. Those Volvo station wagons. I say this, those Volvo station wagons are perceived to be very popular with people who want ironic cars. But I am in the subset of people who honestly believes that Volvo station wagons look cool, but that's just me.
The best thing about the Volvo station wagon is being about 8 years old, surrounded by way too many cousins.
Yeah.
And we all have to pile in to the same car to go to the movies.
Yeah.
You want to be, you don't want to be the first person in. Mm-hmm. You want to be the last person in, because they have to open the trunk.
Yep.
And you get to sit in the trunk seat and watch all, wave at all the other cars.
Yeah.
That's the best thing about
that. I imagine so. My family had a station wagon for about 4 years, and then it went kaput, then we had a truck.
Oh.
And sitting in the bed of a truck is a really interesting dilemma, because boy, it's sweet, and it is the worst riding experience of your life.
I always thought it was illegal.
Oh, it's super illegal.
Oh.
But people in the South don't give a shit.
But see,
Yeah.
I'm from the South.
Yeah, they don't give a shit. If they see you ride in the back of the big truck, they're like, ha ha, hey ho, hey ho, hey hey.
All of them.
And then they give you a high five, thumbs up, then they wave a Confederate flag at you. And then you're free to go.
Wait. You're driving past, and yeah, they give you a high five.
Yeah, boss hog.
That's gonna hurt, depending on the speed.
I mean, depending.
Depending.
But riding in the back of the truck always kind of hurts.
Oh.
So Volvo station wagons, here's the thing.
Oh, yes, back to that.
Back to millennials and why people say millennials are hipsters, hipsters are millennials, this weird interconnect. We talked already about how millennials as a thing don't really exist, because when you create blankets, it makes it really hard to see the individual.
Yes.
Hipster is the same thing.
Really?
So what hipsters are, or at least the perceived hipster, and the perceived hipster that's published about in, like, the New York Times,
we're talking about
Tribune, any mainstream article that talks about hipsters is talking about hipsters from about 4 or 5 years ago.
So, I mean, we're talking the articles with the guy with the skinny jeans and,
yeah,
and the lumberjack jacket and the full beard with the cup of coffee, the price tag still on it.
Yeah.
Unironically using a Walkman.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
So they always attack, or at least, I don't want to say attack because that's taking a stance that I can't really speak on. But they always talk about hipsters from 4 or 5 years ago, and some of these people still exist. But I think the ones that still exist are this, like, stylistic vestige of what hipsterism, quote-unquote, used to be.
Okay.
And I think that hipsterism, as a thing, has existed throughout times. It goes back, if you wanted to trace it back to its earliest, like, most identifiable roots, it's like the beatniks, right?
Okay. Oh, yeah, the guys with the you know, the little French hat and the little glasses. And
yeah, and they'd bang on bongos and call each other cat.
We're all black with the oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
They would, yeah. Cool. You're a cool cat.
Yeah, exactly. I think hipsters, quote unquote, because I hate the word hipster to death, were people who were searching for, so Maslow's hierarchy of needs, something I bring up in conversation but hate. So let's talk about self-actualization.
Of course, as always.
So self-actualization in my Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Maslow's hierarchy of needs, for people who are listening to the podcast and don't know what that is a pyramid that at the base is like pure physiological needs, and it's like companionship, esteem, and at the top is self-actualization. It's like you need these things before you have the other things. Self-actualization is realizing yourself to be the picture of yourself you want to see in reality. It's bringing reality and your perception of yourself together to make one circle.
So,
yeah,
if I may offer a comparison,
mm-hmm,
it's like the movie Avatar, where Jake Sully becomes one of the little blue people.
Yeah.
Jake Sully had lost his legs, but as mm-hmm a blue people, he can walk around.
I mean,
so he becomes actualized in the fact that he can walk around as a blue pupil, and then he keeps walking around.
That's actually totally accurate.
I know.
Because, like, in Avatar, and it couldn't have been spelled out more because Avatar was just, like, this huge spectacle, but it was this person who loved adventure and happiness and wholesomeness who very badly wanted to be mobile, not just walk, but walk, fly, yeah. ride. And his avatar blue person, it became one thing. So that's his self-actualization.
And, you know, it's really cool that I could bring that up because I just proved that that movie left a cultural footprint Twitter. Jesus Christ, stop tweeting about it.
It did. It really did. I don't know. I like to say that Avatar is like being raped in the eyes of money. Untrue. Every James Cameron movie has a little tiny twig of importance. It really does.
Yeah.
It really does.
Because there... Okay. For people who are lost, which is everyone, because I speak in riddles.
We really went to 100 very quickly on this podcast.
Well, that's what they signed up for. They put their quarters in and they got a podcast.
They put their credits in and then they were like, they receive a podcast.
We're a video game. And
we are a video game.
We're playing their minds.
Waka waka. I'm Galaga.
A few weeks ago or so, someone on Twitter was just like, oh, you know, Avatar is the highest grossing movie of all time. This is pre The Force Awakens.
Mm-hmm.
Can you know name two of the characters or like can you remember anything from the movie? And they're trying to make the point that, oh, it's the most grossing movie of all time, but it didn't really touch the cultural footprint.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just over here going, well, there's Jake Sully.
Mm-hmm.
He's the protagonist, and then of course I can't remember any of the other names, so yeah. I look like a person who doesn't know anything. Zero credits.
But the thing is, there's this weird conflation that happens within things like Twitter or social media. Just, okay, Twitter and Tumblr, right?
The big T's.
This thing where this utmost importance is placed on plot and storytelling for meaning. And that is almost 100% what creative output, especially in a visual medium like movies, is not about.
Yeah.
Plot and storytelling are not what you should really take away from movies. If you take away something important, some idea that you hadn't considered before, or something that has made an idea more concrete, a movie worked. Because who gives a shit what any of the characters' names were? Okay, so we remember Star Wars, right?
Which one?
I don't know, the first three.
The original trilogy?
Yeah.
I know all
four,
their...
4, 5, and 6.
I know all their names.
Yeah, you remember the characters' names. Because 4, 5, and 6 didn't tackle any particularly interesting subjects. Any interesting subjects that they worked on before were done in, like, the Impregnable Fortress or Kurosawa films or anything like that.
You mean the Hidden Fortress.
Is that right?
I think so.
Maybe. It's been a while.
We'd have zero credits.
It's true. I'm just saying that, like, the thing about Star Wars that did so well and continues to do well, it didn't for three movies, but it did just now in The Force Awakens. It tells a really compelling story.
Okay.
Does it assault you with really compelling ideas? Hell no.
But what about in The Phantom Menace with all the Treg regulation talk? That's something that's never been
Man,
done.
That really stuck with society. How all those Asian stereotypes tried to gas the space gods to death. Man.
I feel like we distracted you from your first point. You
no
were
idea it, what the first point
the
was.
The hipsters, the hierarchy of needs. You proved what the hierarchy of needs
yeah,
was.
Yeah, so... Track back, self-actualization.
Yes.
The thing that people despise about quote-unquote hipsters is that hipsters were things that had a certain amount of money and privilege that allowed them to browse around the self-actualization store. They took things that they thought were authentic or real or represented them, and they made their identities around them. Because the thing about self-actualization is that when you self-actualize, you don't seem like anybody else. Because it's bringing your consciousness in line with reality, and every consciousness is different.
Huh.
So you ended up with this stylistic interpretation of hipsters, which is this, like, undercut-having, trucker-hat-wearing, vest-wearing, skinny-jean-wearing, strange, atonal music-listening asshole. But it's all based on these people who had the right amount of privilege to browse self-actualization, and people hate self-actualization. They really do, because if you haven't self-actualized, you're resentful for those who have.
Oh, okay. So those who aren't happy are mad at the people who are, quote, happy, or at least pretending to be happy.
I mean, I'm not saying hipsters are happy. It's just that they've explored a realm that most people can't comfortably explore through either lack of money or lack of means or lack of confidence.
Yeah, I was drawing a non-parallel comparison. I'm sorry.
I just mean people want, especially today, in the age of, like, the death of ownership and all this shit. No one owns anything anymore, right?
What does that mean?
I'm just saying, like, you're listening to this podcast right now through a microphone. You're listening to it through iTunes. It's aggregated through an RSS feed, which is being hosted through a website, which is being recorded by us.
So what you're saying, sort of, is that the medium is no longer the message?
No, what I'm saying is the medium through which people get anything is no longer their own. Like, the only thing people really own is their body, right?
I mean,
but people don't own homes. What's American home ownership right now? 63%, I think I read. That's an all-time low. People rent, they lease. Nothing belongs to anyone, so they want authenticity. They want things that are their own. And if those things are appropriated from earlier time periods, it's seemingly outlandish to people who don't have the money or confidence to get that.
Okay. But hold up. What is the body but the primal medium? We experience everything through our body, but yeah. What are we experiencing? Are we the mind or are we the body?
All right. So this gets into the zero credits thing, because this is entirely non-psychological semi-existentialism. I think of my brain, my consciousness, as the only thing I own as ephemeral as that can be, because, you know,
okay,
you hear these stories about people who are, like, riding their bikes and they get hit with a car, they lose time, they wake up in a hospital. That moment of their consciousness is not their own because they can't recall it. It's the teleportation disembodiment dilemma of, like, if your body is destroyed to teleport somewhere else, but you maintain the same memories, did you die?
Okay, so, spoiler alert, but the ending of Prestige. The Prestige.
Yeah, exactly. So The Prestige is legitimately one of my favorite movies.
It's a really good film, and I'm really okay if we don't ditch everything we were talking about to just talk about The Prestige.
We might, but I'm just saying, like, the thing about The Prestige that's a really interesting philosophical question that I was talking about is the only thing that we know for sure that we think... Shit, was it... Who said, I think, therefore I am?
I'm going to butcher the name, but it's René Descartes?
Descartes.
Descartes. Yeah. There's S's in it. I'm sorry. He's got S's in his name.
The thing about it is, just think of a day cart.
What's a day cart?
It's like a Walmart cart that you can only push during the day. It's a day cart.
Those don't exist.
That's not the actual pronunciation, but it's the closest you can get without the...
The French?
Without the nuances of French.
All right. So, but yeah, like, he said, I think, therefore I am.
So the only thing that you can be sure that exists is what you're currently thinking, right?
I suppose.
You know, I think, therefore, I am... That led to solipsism, the idea that the only thing you can be sure that exists is your singular consciousness. So to imagine that all other consciousnesses exist are just an exercise in your imagination.
Yeah, I understand that. Yeah. Are you then extending your ownership thing to our mind? Our thoughts are the only thing we own.
I mean, what I'm doing is doing an imagination exercise.
Okay.
So let's say... I think, therefore, I am is true. The only thing you can be sure that exists is your current thought, your current, like, electricity running through your synapses.
Okay.
So the easiest imagination exercise to go from there, then, is to think your memories are the only thing that exists, because that's the only thing that's real.
I understand what you're saying, and I want to propose one thing.
Mm-hmm.
If our memories and our thoughts are the only thing we own, the thing that we're thinking right now, what happens when we get a song stuck in our head? That's a thought in our head.
Yeah.
We're not owning that, though, because we didn't write the song.
I mean, then you get into the idea of what...
What is a thought?
Yeah, what is a thought? What is a thought in terms of what you own? Is a thought all-encompassing? So...
You've got borrowed thoughts.
This is a problem in that right now I'm going to talk about Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, which is a book that I've been absorbing over the past 2 weeks.
You've been building up for this book. You basically wanted to talk about this book the entire time. That's why you had me ask you the questions about Avatar.
Pretty much, no.
I know.
But one of the things that he explores is the idea that, not to get into any of it, because there's a lot. I'm 700 pages in.
Okay.
But the thing about it is that the mind... is like a train, alright? So your thoughts, your memories, your experiences, your sense memory, anything like that, is the trailing cars of the train. It's the engine, it's the cars in between, it's the caboose, it's the vegetables headed to Oregon, it's the tractors headed to Oklahoma, right?
Okay.
You can go back there and examine them all you want, but it's never going to change. Your consciousness is the leading edge of the train. It is one millionth of a micrometer ahead of the train, where the train will be in the next instant in time. And that's the only thing you can be sure really exists, is that, because you're experiencing that.
Okay.
And through that, you can infer, through an imagination exercise, that your cars are real, because it is the closest relative of the leading edge. And then from that, you can build the wilderness, the train tracks, everything around, and be like, I also might own this, but the only thing you can be sure that exists is this leading, bleeding edge right in front of the train.
Well, how important is certainty?
Depends on who you ask.
I guess that is a question. So that was all from Zen and the Art of Motorcycle?
Yes, by Robert M. Persig. It's really good.
The full title, though, is...
Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance.
All right.
It has problems. I don't agree with him on half of the things he says, but as a thought exercise book, it's really good.
Oh.
But I'm just saying, I feel like I've been rambling, but I'm just saying, like, if you can assume that your memories are real and your senses are real, then you can assume that your body is real and that you own it. You don't lease your body. You're responsible for it more than you're responsible for anything else. And if you say that ownership is a state of responsibility in a continuum of chaos, then your body is like the only real thing you own. Like, what you put into it is what you get out of it.
So the ultimate form of owning your body would then be self-actualization, where you come into the state of being of just owning your ownership and every, like, owning the responsibility in the wake of the chaos.
So the thing that irritates people with about hipsterism is the aura of ownership that extends from hipsterism is you own your clothes because it's the clothes that no one else is wearing but you like. You legitimately like it. It's not a stylistic choice. It is making choices that are running against the stream.
Okay. How do you deal with the... It's a group of people, sort of all... Not all... Okay, so I'm throwing blanket terms on this because it's hard not to. But a group of people are making similar decisions and that you can sort of easily visually classify them. Is that false self-actualization?
Yes.
And that's what's the annoying part.
I am okay with using the word hipster to describe a stylistic choice.
Okay.
If people listen to music because it is the music they feel they should be listening to, wearing the clothes that they feel they should be wearing, doing the things they feel they should be doing, because they saw people they saw as authentic and they wanted to make it part of themselves, that's hipsters. That's bad. But you can't attack the people who honestly want to chase authenticism, like who really want to be real for a second.
How do you deal with a person who wants to be real, but genuinely listens to Taylor Swift?
If they want to be real and really listen to Taylor Swift, accept them.
All right.
I mean, accept anybody. Like, even these... So,
you hear that? You hear that, John? Accept me.
Yeah.
Because I like Taylor Swift and there's nothing you can do about
it. That's totally fine. Taylor Swift is really technically accomplished, even if all of her music is written by a Swedish dude.
I know, it's really sad, because my favorite thing is they show Diet Coke commercials where she's, like, struggling to write, and I'm just like, well, just give it to the Swedish dude who writes all your stuff.
Just give it to DJ Hamburger, whatever the fuck his name is, and he'll get back to you.
I really wish you had known his name, because now it looks like we've got zero credits. I'm just title dropping every few minutes.
Well, zero credits. I really like the story of it, because it's not an anonymous process. It's not like she puts a quarter into the lyrics machine and something comes out. Someone reviews her life, her decisions, and they're like, oh, you have this feud thing going on, so I wrote you Bad Blood.
Yeah.
I wrote you this song that's catered to you, but I wrote it for you. I'm still your writing team, but you own it. Just give me millions of dollars.
I want millions of dollars.
I mean, that's why we're making this podcast. That's millions of dollars.
That, and I would also like for someone to review my life choices and spit out a thing that I could analyze and be like, how do I improve my life?
The crazy thing about pop music, I was reading an article about this, maybe on The Atlantic or Slate,
you're so title-dropping right now.
I'm just saying, on one of those two places, I was reading an article that's like, the reason why pop music sounds the same is because through focus groups, the average person just wants to listen to the same song over and over again.
It's true. I'm honestly, pop music is engineered to be catchy. It's engineered to sound pleasing after not the first listen, but like the 20th.
I mean, it's supposed to be the Pringles of music. It's supposed to be this font from which you can keep getting these little enjoyments.
Once you pop, you just can't stop pop.
I mean, what's... That's pretty good.
Yes.
What's this girl's name? Richard? No. Something Patton. She made that fight song song.
The fight song song.
Yeah, this is my fight song.
I know the song because you just sang it, but yeah. I don't know who sings it because I don't know singers.
It's something Patton.
Patton Oswalt.
Perfect.
Patton Oswalt sings This Is My Fight Song.
But in Patton Oswalt's famous song, Fight Song,
yeah,
she struck a really interesting balance because she wrote the song, I believe, herself, but it hits all the notes of pop music, being like, this is empowering, it's catchy, it's repetitive. Because people listen to music for two reasons, and it's for, like, introspection and critical analysis, and for simple endorphin rush.
Oh, okay.
90% of that is just the endorphin rush that music gives you.
I thought one of them would be, you know, if you ever hear, like, part of a thing, your mind kind of completes it. It's like,
yeah,
pattern completion.
Mm-hmm.
For a lot of pop music is like, I will get a fragment of it stuck in my head, and then I will struggle to complete, like, it feels like a puzzle.
Yeah, like, so I have this weird thing with songs that's very similar, where it's never the chorus, because the chorus is so easy, you can sing the chorus back and forth in your head, walk it around in circles, replace words. I'm very obsessive about words in my head, but I get 6 or 7 word repetitions of songs stuck in my head, and I can't stop repeating them. But since they're not the chorus, they don't repeat cleanly. So I've been listening to a lot of Killer Mike, because I really like Killer Mike, and there's a part off of his song Big Beast. I don't know who sings it. It's not Killer Mike, but it is the phrase, shoot the racial expletive, let him bleed.
Wow.
And it is said in this sing-song perfect cadence that my mind will just repeat it back and forth and forth and back. I had a shift at work where that happened for 8 hours and it was like torture. It was just perfect for repetition, but never went anywhere.
That's not really a phrase you want stuck in your head either.
It isn't. It isn't, because when my job involves interacting with people who want things on a regular basis and making small talk, and there's this little tiny fragment of doubt in my head being like, if someone comes up to me and asks me, hey, can I have this? I'll be like, oh, shoot the racial expletive, let him bleed.
No!
And they'll be like, you're fired forever.
God.
You're gone.
Oh, no, but I get obsessive over, like, combinations of words in my head, and usually what that means is that, for me, I hate saying this sentence, but because I'm a writer,
yeah,
it usually just means I have to get it down on paper to literally, like, get it out of my mind.
Yeah.
But it will happen when my mind switches off for just, like, that split second that I'll just say the line out loud, kind of testing what would happen if someone said this line out loud, but also kind of like, it needs to get out.
Yeah, exactly. Like, the more you repeat something in your head... Now, this is very particular to me, but I really like number sequences. So I like to think, the number of letters in each word, can I make, like, a logical progression? Can I switch them, flip them around, and keep repeating it in different orders to make it into something beautiful? And I understand this is because I'm crazy and very particular and have some disease that science hasn't discovered yet. But if it gets trapped in my head, God, I want to say it. That's why I'm afraid if someone comes up to me, I'll just say it, because, like, oh, just get it out so I can think of something else. And I can't really, like, listen to music at work, so I can't do that thing where you just banish it by listening to Baker Street or whatever.
You know.
So it's trapped in there. The mind is an interesting thing, because you'd think it would always be in your... It would always operate in your logical best interest, and sometimes it just drives you crazy. It's like, why is this happening to me?
Well, it's you know, it's kind of like dreams, if you think about it. Because dreams, what they're supposed to do is, like, kind of compile the information of the day in a way that, like, you can recall it later. But what usually happens is I end up in the water with an alligator, and I'm freaking the hell out, and I just want to, like, die and wake up. But my dreams don't end that way. I always have to see the logical conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
But something about being in the water of alligators, my mind is thinking that's important.
Yeah.
So it thinks it's in its best interest, but
I mean, the leading edge of science is like, oh, dreams are, you recall things during the day, you get rid of what's not important, but then recurring dreams make no sense.
Yeah.
Because why would dreams recur if you're only recalling memories that happened during the day? Like, a dream I had last night, and I'm very bad, I used to be very good at recalling dreams because I used to practice lucid dreaming, which gave me really poor quality sleep, so I stopped doing it. But the dream I had last night was that I was on Craigslist and I saw this ad. It's like, we will pay you $3 an hour to do this job, and if you do it, we'll give you a free truck. I was like, oh, $3 an hour? They mean $300 an hour. How can I lose? Because, you know, dreams don't make any sense. So I did this job, and this job involved installing this old first-person shooter from the early 90s that was like 2D drawings of a 3D world with really offensive names of weapons that you would pick up, and then if you use them on people, it would cause them real life sadness.
Wait. Like, he used them in the game on
people? Yeah, if you use them in the game on people, they at their computers would feel very sad. They would like, they'd be like, oh, he used like the racial epithet bomb or all this really weird offensive stuff that I'm ashamed that I dreamed about.
Wow.
And it would cause them real life sadness, so I turned it off, and I went and I talked to the person who, I guess, posted the job on Craigslist, who lived in my house.
Of course he did.
I was like, hey man, I really don't want to do this, can I just have my truck and go? Like, I did your job, can I go? And they're like, yeah, if you get $200,000, because we took all the parts out of the truck. And I was like, this is such a scam! And then I woke up, I was like, there's nothing I thought about during the entire day that related in any way to this dream. I can't imagine what my brain would be compiling together.
That sounds kind of wonderful. Like, you know, there's the kind of a trope of like people get stuck in games, and like if they die in the game, they die in real life.
Yeah,
I imagine a movie where it's the same thing, but the people on the outside in the real world, they're just getting sadder and sadder until, like, they're just like, well, I guess I really am just a piece of shit.
Yeah, like fear.com 2, if you die in the game, you get kind of sad in real life. But to be fair, let's be honest, if you ever play video games at a somewhat competitive level, when you die, you do get kind of sad.
I get really angry. Like, severely angry. Like,
I used to get angry, so here's the thing for people on the podcast to learn about John. John used to play a lot of video games, plays a lot less now, but I used to be a quote-unquote competitive Counter-Strike player.
I knew it. I smelled it on you when you walked in.
You smelled the Counter-Strike. Most people who play Counter-Strike do have a very specific smell, but I was very good at it, and I played, well, kind of very good. But I would play a lot, and I used to get so angry about it. Like, I broke a keyboard once, and that's really not cool.
Mm-hmm.
Like, having video games affect you in such a way that you become angry is not great. And I used to do this thing where if I died, since you can't play for the rest of the match, whatever, you die, video games, whatever, I'd just do 10 push-ups.
Nice.
That was a great way to deal with my anger, because it was, like, exerting it in such a way that I wasn't throwing anything.
I used to do the same thing with Team Fortress 2. Although it'd just be do push-ups until the respawn timer was out because, you know, it's a good game unlike Counter-Strike, which makes you die.
Oh, Counter-Strike is garbage.
Makes you die forever.
I did this thing where once I got over my anger, I pretty much stopped playing it competitively because the anger really, like, drove me to keep doing it because I got bitter. I was like, no, I'm going to sit at the computer for 10 hours and get good at this.
Yeah.
To show him. I'm going to show that guy.
That's the one thing about playing video games these days, is like, if you, there are games where you can just sort of, single player games, you can just pick up and play, there's no sort of, like, the learning curve is built into the game, and it's great, you have fun, but any sort of competitive multiplayer game these days, it's kind of just, there's someone who is better than you, and they have played hours and hours, like, more than you, and if you want to get that good, it's like you kind of have to pick one game and kind of dedicate yourself to that one game until eventually it's like, unless you're streaming or like you're sponsored in some way, it becomes a job and it's not fun anymore. And it's just like, let's just go play, I don't know, Dungeons and Dragons.
It really got to this point with me once I had conquered my anger and my weird obsessive tendencies with video games where I would play a new game. My new game was Call of Duty when it came out. and I really, really liked Call of Duty 4, Modern Warfare, and I got kind of good at it, but then quickly the skill ceiling got so high I would die really quickly, and instead of capturing my anger, I just look at the name of the person who killed me and be like, I wish I had their fire, wish I was still in the game, but now what's the point? And then I just fade away from the game. Like, if it got to a point when I was getting killed so rapidly, I'd be like, I can't keep up because my heart can't take it. I can't hold the obsessive, compulsive nature in my heart to get good at this, so you can have it.
It's like you're the boxer who got...
Yeah, exactly.
He lost, you know, one too many times, and
yep.
Everyone's, you know, like the little kid who looked up to him, he's grown up now, he's a teenager, it's like, it's time to get you back in the ring, you've got one more fight, and he's like, I don't think so.
It's like, I literally can't do it, I don't have that inside me anymore.
Yeah.
It's very sad, and it's actually kind of freeing.
Yeah, I mean, one of the happiest days of my life was the last time I played League of Legends, and I was like, that's it. Justin Bieber, 4228, said I was, like, I sucked at the game. You know what? He's right. I quit. And yeah. So, like, after that, I was just like, never again.
I have a tremendous respect. Well, no.
It's an odd respect.
I have an odd respect for people who can regularly play games like League of Legends or Dota or Heroes of the Storm. For our podcast listening audience, these are really nerdy games that take a lot of... The skill ceiling is huge. People are mad at you instantly. You need to dedicate a lot of time to be good at them. A lot of time to be good at them. But the first time I played Dota 2, which is like League of Legends, I played it for 5 minutes. And a voice communication was on. I was sitting there. I was enjoying a nice hot cup of tea and a grilled cheese sandwich. I was like, this is a good day. Sunlight is streaming through my windows. This is good. Life is at its vertex. What do you call the height of something?
Apex.
Apex. Life is at its apex. It's like, this is fine. Life is good. I started the game. I moved for like a minute. And I was like, this is cool. I will learn this. And someone said, stop fucking feeding them. And I was like, hey, what's up? What's this? What's the, like, stop! Stop! Just stop! You're so bad! You're so retarded and bad! I was like, oh! Help? And then they said a million other epithets, and I was like, alright! This is not for me!
It's really weird, but with a lot of online competitive games, the community around it, you know, the people playing the game, who are making the game work and be successful,
yeah,
hate everyone else playing the game.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I played it for about 5 minutes, and in the 5 minutes, I felt like I had stumbled into, like, Chernobyl. Just some toxic waste builds. Like, I'm not supposed to be here. This isn't for humans. And then I left.
Yeah. I mean, maybe rat people play the game. And
yeah. That's gonna be what they are.
On the other side of the screen, there's some rat people playing, and they're like, this is what humans do, be mad. And so they say rat people things into the microphone.
Yeah, like, this is probably very nice rat people things to say, but I'm like, this isn't good for anyone.
Because we're not...
Farewell.
We're not rat people, we're just people.
I had a friend a while ago who referred to people who dedicated large amounts of time to video games as troglodytes.
Oh.
As in, like...
Cave people.
Yeah, cave people, weird lizard people who live under the city... I was like, oh, that works.
Are we talking about the lizard people who have shape-shifted to look like us, who are currently running all of our government and businesses? And if you look very closely, you can see them, like, their skin shifts, and there's video evidence of this, and it's totally real.
No, they're all right.
Oh, you mean, like,
the bad ones.
The bad ones?
Yeah, like the bad eggs, like the people who play League of Legends.
Yeah, so all lizard people play League of Legends. We can throw that blanket over them?
I'm comfortable with this blanket, because honestly, I just don't want to look at them, you know what I'm talking about?
Because they're lizard people.
Yeah, because they're very disgusting.
Yeah. They are, though.
They really are.
Yeah. Oh, we should probably, to any lizard people listening, we're not talking about you!
No!
No, we're just talking about the bad lizard people.
See, look... Some lizard people ruin it for the bunch, okay? One bad lizard egg ruins the dozen.
Not to say that we collect your eggs and sell them in our grocery stores, because those are chicken eggs.
Yeah, that would be very difficult. We would have to guile our way into a lizard man hutch and then steal your eggs, and then we'd sell them, which would be very difficult. Nigh on impossible. Who would do that?
Yeah, and it's not as though Tyson Chicken Farms... It's not really chicken. But anyway.
I mean, the yolks look very similar, but there's no way that they would sell lizard people.
If you break an egg early enough, can you even tell what was in it?
You couldn't. Yeah. We just have to take it on good faith that the people at Tyson and the Sanderson Farms aren't selling lizard people eggs.
They totally are, though, aren't they?
I mean, I don't want to think about it too much.
I think we've fallen off the deep end, man.
I really think we have.
What do we do?
Let's think about this for a second.
Please pause for a moment of silence.
This is going to be a weird break.
What's up?
So, like, okay, so with that end thing, and then, like, what, I put in a few seconds of dead air, and then...
To be fair, we trailed off.
Oh, like, we did trail off?
We were like...
And we're going to trail right back up.
We were like, lizard people eggs, and then you were like, please pause for it, then you can, like, put in a beep and put in maybe a couple pieces of this. Especially the pieces where we sound distant, because that'll give people a little insight into the sausage-making process and us talking and being weird, not on mic.
Please pause for a moment of silence.
I mean, people love that shit. They love feeling like they're part of it.
Yeah.
Just put that part in. Just put the part where I'm distantly saying, people love that shit. They love feeling like they're a part of it. So, full disclosure, I was watching... Not Panic at the Disco, some other shitty band. 30 Seconds to Mars. I was watching 30 Seconds to Mars videos with Natalie. Jared Leto is really good, like, as a lead vocalist. He screams a lot, and I don't like screaming in music. But we were watching... I forget the name of their video that's, like, a Shining reference.
Oh, it's the Shining.
Nope.
Martin Scorsese directed it.
Nope. Incorrect.
No, he directs music videos. He directed a One Direction music video once.
Did he?
Actually, yes.
No, you can't meld the false with the true. Did he actually direct a One Direction music video?
He did.
That is the truth I will accept.
That is the truth.
He did not direct the 30 Seconds to Mars music video because it's kind
no,
of...
No. The truth you shouldn't accept is that The Shining, directed by Martin Scorsese, is a 30 Seconds to Mars music video.
I was going to do the long walk backwards
to
hating on that, but no.
Oh.
We were talking about Jared Leto, and I was like, oh, Jared Leto is an artist, is huge. Like, now he's a movie star, I guess.
Yeah, he is.
With his somewhat misdirected Joker character.
I don't know about that, but have you seen Dallas Buyers Club?
I have not. Everyone... So, okay, I have these two things in my life, and they're called Matthew McConaughey and Jared Leto. And I have the utmost respect for both of them for different reasons. So I really want to see Dallas Buyers Club.
It's about AIDS.
Yeah,
Should we start the podcast?
In a minute. Gummy bear, gummy bear, gummy bear, gummy bear.
We now return you to the podcast you are listening to, already in progress. Oh, so I lead the dance now?
Is that, yeah, for sure. All right. I mean, if you want me to lead, I can, like, come up with some bullshit to talk about.
I mean, why don't you just give me a word?
Like, any word.
Any word.
Let's see. Blue.
Ah, blue. Blue is a color. You know, funny thing.
Yeah.
That used to be like a little mantra for me in high school. Blue as a color is just something... It's one of those... We were talking about things that get stuck in your head.
Yeah.
They repeat over and over again.
Yeah.
Blue as a color was one of those things that got stuck in my head.
The phrase blue as a color?
Yeah. I would write it down on like slips of paper. I would say it to people. And I never did anything with it because, you know, it's such a simple... There's nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
There's nothing to make sense of. It's a blue as a color.
Uh-huh.
But it's just weird that I'm connecting all these dots right now.
I mean, I think the brains are these interesting, flawed computers that, like, get stuck on things. And one of the most fascinating things to experience is, like, a freeze where, like, your brain's like, this idea is this idea and only this idea, this idea.
Yeah.
It's very scary. Like, the song being stuck in your head, or, like, I don't know. So I was raised... religious. That's right, I was raised religious, and I'm not that anymore. Even better. But I was, we had this real fire and brimstone pastor come to our Baptist church, because we went to a Baptist church because I was born Catholic, and my parents wanted to give me structure still, but we lived in the South, so Baptist is...
Well, there's tons of Catholics. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm from a different part of the South where there's tons of Catholics.
You're right, we moved to the Baptist part of the South, and we had this real fire and brimstone one. It's like, if you do not admit that you have given your soul to God, then you will go to hell. And then he described hell for like 3 hours and gave me nightmares because I was like 8.
A real sinner's in the hands of an angry God type, then.
Yeah, exactly.
I read that in high school.
Oh, I didn't.
Yeah.
So I did this thing where I thought... So here's an interesting thought experiment that I read about. What you should do at any time of the day is you should try to very vividly imagine yourself taking a bite of cereal, like 50% milk, 50% cereal on a spoon, and see if you can make it travel slowly up to your mouth in 5 seconds without like shaking it apart or deviating from your... See how concentrated you are at making that happen.
Really?
Like, try it. Just try to think and try to keep your mind focused enough to not imagine not making the bite happen. Close your eyes.
Oh, I have to close my eyes.
And see if you can make it perfect. Like, no redos.
This will be great for podcasting material.
It will be 5 seconds of silence. Just a pure cereal bite. Perfect.
Am I supposed to mimic it?
You just think about
just
it.
Just think it.
Don't do it with your body. Nothing else to aid you.
All right.
It's actually a meditation thing.
All right. Oh, I'm going.
So let's see if you can do it.
All I can think about is puppies.
See? Well, that's also true. But it's like, if you can focus on that, if you can not sabotage yourself, you're of sound mind at the moment.
That's weird. But see, like, when people tell me to imagine a thing or try to imagine a thing, my brain is just like, why are you listening to this person tell you what to do?
Yeah.
And that, but I thought I would grow out of that, but now I'm like a much older, and so, you know, my mind is just like holding up a middle finger to the meditation guy.
My mind is like a landmine field of awful shit at any given moment. But anyway, so when he says you have to think I gave my soul to God, you have to believe that. My brain went, hey, gave my soul to Satan, hey. So my brain kept thinking, I'm gonna think that. Don't let me think that. So I had this obsessive compulsive problem when I was a kid,
yeah,
of having to repeat the mantra of I gave my soul to God, I gave my soul to God, not going to hell, over and over again. And it became this like mania.
That's
for
wow.
Like a week. And then I was like, oh, it doesn't matter. Like, thoughts are thoughts. We have to embrace that we both want the best for ourselves, and we want the worst for ourselves.
Yeah.
You know, we're large and contain multitudes. But that might also be, like, a very specific mental problem that I have that hasn't been diagnosed yet.
You keep saying that, and, you know, eventually it might come true.
Eventually it might, and I'd be perfectly okay with that, because I don't have any problem with medication, and I want my problems solved.
Just like any other red-blooded American man.
It's true. In this, the American century of medication.
I don't want to talk about it.
That's fair. What do you want to talk about?
Well, here's a religious story from my childhood.
Alright.
I was brought up Presbyterian.
Uh-huh.
Still am.
But, that's fair. That's probably the one, what's, denomination?
Yeah.
The one denomination I know the least about is Presbyterians.
Well, here's the story.
All right.
When you're a child of a Presbyterian sort of religion, you develop a thought in your head that flipping the bird,
yeah,
is bad.
Of course.
Because if you do it up, it's pointed to God.
Oh.
So, I inversed it. If I flip it down,
it's pointing to Satan.
I'm hurting Satan.
Of course.
I mean, walked around doing this all the time going, look at this, Satan.
You're like,
can't
fuck you,
stop
Satan.
Me.
Fuck
and then,
you, Satan.
And then I would thumbs up to God.
Yeah.
To like, you know, be like, here's your power.
Yeah.
And then, you know, ha, Satan.
But I mean, if you ever gave a thumbs down to say that you didn't like something, were you giving a thumbs up to Satan?
I have no idea. I mean, I was like 5, 6 at this point, and then eventually, like, my sister had to, she was a bit of a anything you like, I will crush type.
Yeah, same.
So she saw me doing that, and I tried to explain, no, I'm doing it to Satan. And she's like, that's not how it works.
Oh.
You're doing it to a person, and you're bad, and you're going to hell.
Oh, wow.
And I was just like, well, I guess there goes my fun little game.
I mean, she got you.
Oh, seriously. I don't want to talk about it.
Yeah.
But yeah.
That's fair. One of the things that I did as a kid, and still kind of do, once again, mental problem that probably needs to be diagnosed.
You want me to diagnose you?
Is when I was a kid.
Guess not.
I used to hate the tension of, like, I have pretty kind of bad social anxiety disorder. Like, talking to people makes me very nervous. And I do it a lot, so I guess I've gotten over it to some degree. But if ever I would pass by someone, let's say in a bookstore when I was a kid, like 10 or 11, they'd like look at me, I'd look at them, and the tension of that tiny interaction would be so unbearable that like the second they couldn't see me, I'd like flip them the bird under my jacket, like make some dumb face, or do something in rebellion to be like, that tension meant nothing, I am destroying it. There's this weird coping mechanism. I still do it, like sometimes in classes when professors are being terse to me, I'll just like flip them a little bird under the desk and be like, this is for you. This is me showing that the tension doesn't exist.
This is my little secret.
Yeah, it's like, this is my little secret rebellion to you. It's like those people who get like those underhawks, like they shave a strip of their hair off, but their hair is long so you never see it. It's like, oh, this is my little rebellion. No one sees it, but I know it's there. It gives me some amount of comfort.
That's really interesting.
Is it? I mean, it's at least somewhat interesting.
I thought it was interesting, but then you questioned me, and, you know, I had to second guess, and I reevaluated my entire life to come to the conclusion that that wasn't really interesting.
Oh no, I'm feeling tense.
Stop flipping me the bird!
You can't see it!
You're covering it with your other hand! It's obvious!
That's just something I do. I like to think that my entire life is just relieving some unseen tension that no one else feels.
So, in a way, and I know you haven't read the book yet, but you're kind of like a Don DeLillo character in that way.
Okay.
Let's
talk about White Noise or whatever.
You haven't read it yet.
I haven't. It's next on the docket.
I've read that. I've read Cosmopolis.
He did Cosmopolis?
He did Cosmopolis.
I've heard a lot of really good things about Cosmopolis.
For
those in the podcast listening audience, Don DeLillo is an author.
Yes. Yes, an author of books in the English-American language, I suppose. He's an American author.
Okay.
Contemporary. He actually wrote... 9/11 was a big event.
Yes, it was.
And there was a still photo released around that time of a man who had jumped from one of the windows in the towers.
Yeah, yeah.
He came to be known as the Falling Man.
Okay.
Don DeLillo wrote a book called The Falling Man.
Okay.
Never read it. Never had an interest.
Well, I suppose you should read that next.
I guess. I think he came out with one this past end of the year. So, like, late 2015, I think he came out with another book.
Uh-huh.
But White Noise is probably the best.
Every time someone describes something about White Noise to me, it sounds tremendously interesting, so I can't wait to actually read it.
Yeah, I really don't want to talk about it before you've read it. After you've read it, hell, we could just dedicate an entire episode to White Noise.
I mean, one of the cool things about this podcast is you, the podcast listening audience, gets to hear us become more knowledgeable over time because, you know, we're humans in process. We're still in that big fucking light bulb based easy bake oven called life, and one day we're going to come out as beautiful goopy cupcakes and you'll be like, delicious. I feel like I really lost the thread on that.
I think it held together.
Unlike those cupcakes.
Yeah. Look, you don't have to, like, lambast my cooking in front of our guests.
What cooking? Am I right?
My attempt at cooking?
Ladies.
What do you want from me? Honesty? I'm honest.
I mean, okay. Look, this podcast is a great place to be honest.
I know.
You ate a pizza for, like, 3 days.
I ate a pizza for like 3 days?
Or 2 days? What was that Little Caesars deep dish pizza you told me about?
Oh,
let's
yeah.
not get into this.
Look. The thing to do when you're poor is to buy as much food as possible.
Oh no, I get that.
For as little money as possible.
I totally get that.
The pizza is the perfect thing to split into multiple meals.
Yeah. I mean, it's divided into meals.
You just eat just two slices at a time for four meals.
Yeah.
That could be 4 days.
I mean, the best thing I ever bought when I was in my deepest points of poverty was a rice cooker. Except jasmine rice tastes all right. I can buy a bag for $3 that'll feed me for like 10 days. I mean, to the detriment of my health, of course, but like...
Well, you know, we're not talking about health.
Oh, of course not.
We're just talking about wallet health.
I mean, if you... Wallet health and body health very rarely are at an intersection.
I mean, and we live in America, so of course, wallet health is superior.
Of course, I mean...
If you don't have a strong wallet, you better write home.
I mean, what good's it gonna do you if you're like a super healthy homeless guy? Nothing.
Actually, wait, they're actually... This is so weird. There's a super healthy bodybuilding homeless guy in France.
Okay.
He's homeless.
That sounds cool as fuck.
Yeah, he's homeless, but like, he is ripped.
Yeah.
And he kind of just walks around kind of like working out where he can.
I mean, I guess if I was homeless, that's what I'd do.
But my question is like, how does he eat? I guess like... He does push-ups for tips or something? Like,
he probably does push-ups for tips. Also, it's a European country, so probably the systems they have in place to help the homeless are way better than ours.
Oh, well, I mean, now that you brought that up, that...
Not to get political or anything.
I know, but it's super obvious now. The mystery is gone.
I mean, not really.
You've named the atom, and now we know what we're composed of, John. There's no more small gnomes running through the ether, giving us energy and life. How do you feel?
One of my dreams is to go to prison.
One of your dreams is to go to prison? That's how you feel?
No. Okay, so I think that going to prison would be super cool if prison were, like, a different thing. Like, if prison... Especially American prisons, wasn't this, like, weird machismo factory where people just went and died and most of our population wasn't in prisons or whatever.
Yeah.
But I think prison as an idea is very cool because, like, talking about self-actualization, if you have a limited options, you can just read and work out and eat. All your food's provided for you. You can live inside your mind and your body for years at a time. It sounds like the most intense form of meditation.
Yeah, people earn degrees in prison somehow.
Yeah, I mean, they do, like, distance learning classes.
Yeah.
I will never hopefully go to prison.
Ooh.
But I'm just saying, like, if... This is a really odd thing to say, but if you locked me away for years, I wouldn't hate it. I probably wouldn't like it. But I really like to be alone. I like to work out. I like to read books. I like to drink water and stare at a wall. I'm basically the perfect prisoner. But I'm the worst prisoner because I'm the least likely to commit a crime.
There's not an award, John, for these categories.
You know, in high school, the non-existent high school that I went to, I was elected least likely to commit a crime.
But wait, you were homeschooled.
It's true. I didn't actually. This was what I like to call a bit.
You know what's weird? What's weird that is I was not. High school wasn't a good time for me.
I doubt it's a good time for anyone.
I was nominated for most likely to succeed.
Yeah.
Let's fast forward 6 years. I've got 2 degrees.
Yeah.
No job.
Yeah.
And I just described how to live 4 days on eating one pizza.
I mean, to be fair, you weren't...
I didn't win most likely to succeed.
But you weren't nominated for most likely to make a large amount of money. You're succeeding. You've got 2 degrees. Think of all the people from your high school who ended up, I don't know...
Being chemical engineers and having really good jobs. All of them.
Pregnant or on fire or a newt. Imagine all the people in your high school who turned into newts.
They'll get better.
Will they? They haven't found a cure for nudism.
I don't know. I saw a documentary once called Monty Python and the Holy Grail, and they had a guy who suffered from nudism, and he got better.
It's true. But what can you... Look, you can't just quote your conspiracy theory documentaries to me and say that this is the truth.
Isn't that... One-third of all the things I've said on Zero Credits, our podcast, has been exactly what you described.
Conspiracy theory nonsense?
A little bit. I went on about lizard people for like 20 minutes.
I think we've broken open the sweet egg that is Zero Credits, and now you can reap the benefits of our thick yolk.
Does that mean you want me to... I mean, we're doing this live. You want me to... What are you saying?
So crack open that microphone and eat its thick yolk. Don't do that. It's not good for the recording.
Okay, well, I was about to do it, so I'm glad you said not to.
We should probably bring this episode to a close so we can crack this microphone.
That's what you were trying to tell me?
To bring this episode to a close? Maybe.
All right, listeners, here's the thing. John doesn't want me to tell you this, but we're on iTunes now, which means you can rate or leave a comment, and we would really appreciate if you did one or the other or both. But most importantly, share this with anyone who will listen to you.
Share this with anyone. So one of the greatest things you can have in life is people who trust your opinion. And anyone who actually trusts your opinion is a true friend, and you should turn to that person as you lay comfortably in your beds and say, please listen to Zero Credits. Give them a chance.
Goodbye.